Please call the case.
Case number SCWC29550, State v. Kalar. Arguing for the petitioner, Jason Z. Fay. Arguing for the respondent, Stephen Tsushima. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, Mr. Say and Mr. Tsushima. Are you both ready to proceed today? All right. And Mr. Say, my understanding is you'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, so the yellow light will go on with 10 minutes remaining in your argument, okay? And Mr. Tsushima will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go in your argument. Very well. Please proceed, Mr. Say. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Deputy Public Defender Jason Say on behalf of the petitioner, Enrico Kalara. We come before this honorable court today to respectfully ask that Mr. Kalara's conviction for sexual assault in the fourth degree be vacated and that the case be remanded for new trial. The basis for our request are the 5 points of error, grave error, that are committed by the trial court that we have outlined in our petition. Now, these 5 errors alone are harmless. However, what's of more concern is the prejudicial cumulative effect that these errors have had in denying the defendant of his right to a fair trial. The first issue that...
I'm sorry, did I miss... You said they are harmless or harm... The 5 errors are individually harmless?
I'm sorry, are not harmless.
Right, okay, thank you.
However, the more grave concern is the...
Cumulative effect. Thank you. Errors.
Thank you, Your Honor. The first issue I'd like to address is that the... Although the ICA is correct in finding that Aunt Teresa's testimony about the complainant's statements to be hearsay were inadmissible, the ICA error, however, in finding that the inadmissible hearsay was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, the statement that Aunt Teresa gave describing the complainant's discussion with her about the defendant touching her breast were inadmissible under HRA 803B2 because the complainant was too far away removed from the alleged offense. The complainant's statements were neither spontaneous nor impulsive. They were made several hours after the event, after first riding in the car with the defendant and the defendant's wife, after speaking with the counselor with the state for 2 hours and informing the counselor of the acts that took place, after calling Aunt Teresa first on the phone, and then subsequently meeting Aunt Teresa in person and relaying these statements to her. The statements were not a result of reflective thought and therefore not admissible as an excited utterance. So on that point, the ICA is correct. However, they're gravely erroneous in finding that this was not harmless error. The standard of review for harmless error is outlined by the state, and the ICA's primary authority on this is governed by State versus Clark. This error must not be analyzed in isolation or considered purely in the abstract. It must be taken in the whole context of the proceedings, and then a determination must be made whether there is a reasonable possibility that the error might have contributed to conviction. And in this case, there is a very real possibility that this inadmissible hearsay statement contributed to the defendant's conviction. State v. Clark is clearly distinguishable from this case. The ICA held in State v. Clark that even if there was inadmissible hearsay, it would have been harmless in that case due to the cumulative effect of all the other testimony. Now, in Clark, there was a testimony of an officer, an investigating officer, three medical personnel, and also a recorded statement of complainant's prior comments, as well as a lot of physical evidence in that case. And analyzing those statements, which first the ICA found that the officer's statements and the two doctor statements were hearsay exceptions under the excited utterance rule, they did not rule whether the nurse's statements were inadmissible hearsay. They seem to have leaned towards that conclusion based on their analysis. They did not make a finding on it. However, they did rule that even if it was inadmissible hearsay, it would have been harmless because of the cumulative effect. And that situation is just not present in the current case. The only other testimony, only other evidence in this case talking about the acts is from the complainant herself, that there was a physical contact that night. So other than this hearsay testimony, which was found inadmissible by the ICA, there's no other cooperating evidence to verify the complainant's.
But wasn't the defense theory of the case that the complaining witness had fabricated this matter in order to develop a pretext so she could move to the Auntie Teresa's house, the aunt's house, correct?
That's correct.
And if so, if that was the defense theory of the case, how is it harmful that that statement was admitted?
It improperly bolstered the complainant's testimony, as it was inadmissible hearsay. Second, I believe the court in State versus Ely did an analysis on there needs to be a confident level of trustworthiness, of reliability to these hearsay statements. And in the situation that you just mentioned, Your Honor, there would be a highly suspect motive for why the complainant would make these statements to Aunt Teresa, possibly for the effect of garnering her sympathy so that she could move into.
But wasn't that exactly the defense theory of the case? Isn't that what defense counsel argued at trial, in effect? So how is it harmful if that's, in fact, set up the defense theory of the defense? How is the admissibility of the statement harmful if it, in fact, was consistent with the theory of the defense?
I'm not sure that it was consistent with the defense's.
Well, what was the defense's theory? Why did the complaining witness in the defense's view at trial manufacture this story? Because that, of course, was the argument.
Yes, Your Honor. The defense's theory was that this incident never took place to begin with. And the only evidence in this case, first, there was no physical evidence. There's no third-party eyewitness testimony. And there's also no admission. So the only thing the jury had to base its decision on was the testimony in this case, primarily the testimony of the complaining witness.
And at trial, did the defense offer a theory as to why the complaining witness was testifying incorrectly or falsely?
We did.
And what was that theory?
Because of the motive of the complainant to garner sympathy and
from
be able to
garner sympathy from whom?
From Aunt Teresa in order to move into her residence, to leave her current situation and to have a place of residence.
Which was exactly what was established by the testimony that the complaining witness went to Aunt Teresa and told her this what she said had happened to her, correct? That's what basically was the foundation for that argument, was the testimony we're talking about.
I see your point, Your Honor. However, the greater danger here is that the jury would have taken this hearsay testimony from Aunt Teresa as confirming the allegations made by the complainant in this case, and that's a more prejudicial effect.
Could it be admissible as a prior consistent statement? Under Rule 613, and also the hearsay rule allows for the admission of prior consistent statements in certain circumstances. Is that an alternate grounds for upholding the admissibility of the statement or not applicable in this case?
I don't believe it's applicable in this case, as there was no
Did the state argue that? 613?
They did
prior consistent?
I do not recall them arguing that in this case.
But we can affirm for any basis that appears in the record, correct? Evidentiary rulings, we can affirm them for whatever basis appears in the record.
I believe this court does have sua sponte jurisdiction.
Would the defense did the defense pursue this theory of the CW wanting to move to the aunt's house through cross-examination of the CW herself?
Yes, we were allowed to cross-examine this.
All right, so the defense did not offer the Teresa's testimony for the purpose of showing this motive, right?
No,
the defense objected to this testimony on the hearsay grounds.
That is correct. Yes. And based on the inadmissible hearsay being not harmless in this case because it is not consistent with the State v. Clark ruling, we would ask that this conviction be vacated. The second issue that I'd like to address is that the detective's testimony in this case, Detective Denault, that he had probable cause to arrest the defendant, was first irrelevant. And secondly, and more grave concern, is that it had a prejudicial effect of improperly bolstering the complainant's testimony. First off, I believe this issue should be analyzed under de novo by this court, under the right-wrong standard instead of the plain error standard. Defense preserved its objections during both motions in limine and again during trial. The relevant evidence here is controlled under HRE 401, which is evidence having any tendency to make the existence of any fact that is of consequence to the determination of the action more probable or less probable than it would be without the evidence.
You know, counsel, the court, when it ruled on your motion in limine, indicated that it wanted to, it would allow the probable cause question because it was necessary for the jury to realize the difference between proof beyond a reasonable doubt and, say, I guess, probable cause to arrest. What do you think about that rationale?
Your Honor, you are correct in that the court analyzed this issue and then found that it was proper for the court to do so for the benefit of the jury. However, that is a grave concern to the defense in this case, or just to the substantial rights of the defendant to a fair trial. The court itself recognized that there was a danger of the jury misinterpreting probable cause as satisfying the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. And that's the reasoning that the court gave to allow the detective to testify about that. However, after analyzing this issue and allowing the probable cause statement, there was no curative instruction to the jury clarifying this for them. The danger of this is that as individuals trained in the law, we understand that probable cause has essentially nothing to do with finding the defendant beyond a reasonable doubt. However, the danger is the jury does not understand the difference, and it's a very real possibility here that the jury, upon hearing the detective testify that there was probable cause in this case to arrest, that they equated that to satisfying the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt.
How much time is remaining in his argument? I saw the yellow light go. Yeah, it's okay. You still have some time to go in your opening, just to clarify. Yeah.
The detective's exact statements in this case was that based on the complaint written by the complaining witness, which included the offense of sexual assault in the fourth degree, which involved sexual contact to another person without consent, she affirmed the statement, identified the defendant, and then probable cause was established. So there's actually more error in the detective's statement in that he informed the jury, testified to the jury, that the elements of sexual assault 4 were met by the complainant, and then further complicated matters by stating that probable cause was established in this case.
Going back to the excited utterance issue, you said that it was the exception would not be allowed because of the difference in time between the incident and the statement.
Yes, sir.
But in the Moore case, didn't this court say that the victim's hearsay statement to, I guess it was either the police or emergency personnel, was admissible even though the shooting took place a substantial amount of time before the statement?
Your Honor, I must admit, I'm not too familiar with the Moore case, but if my recollection is correct, in that case, the court determined that the complainant was still under the duress of the incident, still suffering from the traumatic effects of that situation. In this case, again, the alleged incident happened in the early morning hours of March 13th, somewhere between 12 a.m. And 2:30 a.m. The complainant testified that she was up at 6 a.m. She caught a ride from the defendant and the defendant's wife. There was no there was no uneasiness during this ride, no situation that came up. She spent 2 hours at the state counselor's office, discussed the incident with the counselor, then proceeded to call the Aunt Teresa, and then met her in person. So a significant amount of time passed. A lot of superseding events happened before this statement was made. It would be, in our argument, a stretch to claim that the complainant was still under the duress, still under the stress of the incident that happened, and therefore it's not an excited utterance, but a statement made on reflective thought.
Isn't the standard that the statement must be made not only reasonably contemporaneously, but without opportunity for deliberation or influence? And in this situation, what is your argument as to the opportunity for deliberation or influence?
Your Honor, I think the most telling act that took place, or the most significant act that took place, is that she sat with a state counselor for 2 hours. This was a counselor that was helping her get, I believe, welfare benefits. The counselor must have some training authorized by the state to deal with families or deal with individuals that are going through hard times. And they sat for 2 hours and discussed this issue. And only after this consultation did she call Aunt Teresa, and then met Aunt Teresa in person. It wasn't a spontaneous, immediate impulse to pick up the phone after the incident happened and call Aunt Teresa. This didn't happen until she had a conversation with the counselor. So based on consultation, reflective thought before she took any type of action.
Counsel, you know, with respect to the January 2000. Was it 2006 or 2007?
And, Your Honor, we apologize to the court. There was some typographical errors. It was January and February 2007.
Okay, with respect to the 2007 statements, you claim that the court failed to give a limiting instruction, and that was plain error.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So whose obligation is it to give a limiting instruction? Is it your obligation to request one, or is it the court's obligation to give it?
Well, in the heat of trial or the stress of trial, there are issues that are missed by both defense and the state. But the ultimate duty, the ultimate responsibility of ensuring that the defendant has a right to a fair trial, and that means being properly instructed of the law, the ultimate responsibility duty lies with. And therefore, in this case, the two statements that were made were so prejudicial in nature, and it was recognized by the court during motions in limine, again objected to during trial. The court recognized the prejudicial nature of these statements, and the state's offer of proof of why they were being asserted was strictly for the purposes of showing intent and lack of consent.
And counsel, how would you square that with Rule 105 of the Rules of Evidence that said, when evidence is admissible as to one party or for one purpose, but not admissible as to another party or for another purpose, the court, upon request, shall restrict the evidence to its proper scope and instruct the jury accordingly. So the rule states that it's upon request. How do you square that with the position you're arguing today?
You are correct, Your Honor. Rule 105 does state upon request. However, under the plain error doctrine, if the court finds that there were material errors or that the defendant's rights were substantially impacted, this court does have the jurisdiction to review the case and to determine that a limiting instruction was required in this situation.
Can we go to the court's reasons? The court's reasons for admitting this, even before we get to whether or not a limiting instruction should have been given, the court's reasons were, as I understood, lack of consent. Was there any testimony that the complainant consented? I mean, that the defendant raised the fact that she consented?
That was not an issue in the case whatsoever.
Okay,
our argument is that the state, in effect, put on a preemptive strike in regards to admitting those statements.
So if it was going to be, if the defense had raised that, then the only appropriate place would have been rebuttal.
That is our assertion.
Now, I don't understand also the argument that it comes in for intent. Intent means that somebody acted with purpose or with knowledge or with recklessness. Was there any dispute in this case of intent?
There was zero dispute in regards to intent. And I'd like to also state the State v. Castro case where the court finds that even if evidence would be relevant, there still must, and even if they find that it might be admissible under 404B, or even if it passed the 404B standard, there still must be a balancing test done under HRE Rule 403. And there's certain factors that must be looked at. The strength of the evidence as to whether the statements were made, the similarities between the statement and the alleged crime, interval of time that elapsed.
Is this even 404B stuff?
In our argument, we assert that it is 404B evidence in that these statements are alleged verbal harassment of the complainant by the defense, and therefore a balancing test must be done under 403.
But you don't get to that balancing test unless you can bring it in one of those exceptions in 404B, and if there's no contesting of intent. In other words, if the testimony of the defendant had been, well, I touched the person, but I wasn't trying to get into that area,
sure,
or I started to touch. But this is a case where he said he didn't do it. He wasn't there. So I'm not sure how state of mind or intent or absence of consent is, how any of that justifies it.
We don't feel it was an issue in this case. And even under the Castro factors, the need for the evidence, there were other adequate facts in this case that could have established intent and lack of consent for the state. The alleged incident happened in the early morning hours of March 13th. The complainant claimed that her door was locked, that the defendant came in, picked the lock while the complainant was sleeping.
I guess the question is, you know, why is intent or consent even an issue in this case if the defense is that it never happened?
It's not an issue in this case, and those statements.
If it's not an issue, then why would the evidence be allowed?
It was improperly admitted. It's irrelevant to this case under 401. And because the statements were admitted, there should have been some sort of limiting instruction, because even if they were admitted, they were for the specific purpose of going towards the defendant's intent and lack of consent.
You only need a limiting instruction if the evidence should go to the jury, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Assuming arguendo that the court does find that it was relevant.
Can you address the pipe issue?
The pipe issue?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor. The defense's hands were essentially tied, and they were prevented from putting on a complete defense when the trial court precluded them from questioning the complainant about her possible drug use on the day of the
incident. Was that actually prevented? Wasn't your notice of intent just asked to admit the pipe? And then it was just to admit the pipe, and the court was just talking about the pipe in its ruling.
Well, Your Honor,
never said you can't discuss drug use, possible drug use.
The defense in this case was very clear that the state prohibited them from asking these questions, and the discussion during motions in limine verifies this point. The defense counsel, Mr. Rott, in this case, asked the court. The court was reluctant to introduce any of that evidence, but Mr. Rott asked, well, I should be allowed, this is on page 59 of the motions in limine transcript, well, I should be allowed to then cross-examine her at least on that. At the minimum, you know, that she smoked marijuana. Ms. Durant continues, does she smoke a substance that requires a pipe? And then the complainant can say no. The court was still reluctant. Ms. Durant continues on page 60. Well, Your Honor, it's not hearsay because she observed it. Ms. Calara, the defendant's wife, it's relevant because if she was smoking marijuana at the time of the incident or she was under the influence of drugs, it goes to her perception. That's what it's being offered for. That's Ms. Duran's exact quotes, which is proper under State v. Buttengall. The court refuted Ms. Duran, did not allow the defense to question, not only introduce the pipe question on the drug use, and this is what the court's exact ruling was. This is on page 60 to 61. I think the evidence is so remote, so tangential, and so unreliable as to whether or not this is Ms. the complainant's pipe and whether she smoked it in the early morning hours of March 13th that the court should not allow this. And it continues on. There was a good faith basis for the defense to question the complainant as to her alleged possible drug use going towards her perception and recollection of the events. This is, again, based on the State v. Buttenbaum case where it was improper to use this evidence for veracity, to impeach her veracity or credibility. However, for recollection and perception, it was a valid challenge. And that's the limited purpose that Mr. Rant was introducing, seeking to introduce the evidence for.
She asked to be able to cross-examine on this.
She did.
Specifically, I should be allowed then to cross-examine her, at least on that. At the minimum, you know, that she smoked marijuana. And the judge just goes right, doesn't answer or anything. And in his ruling, does the judge ever say, well, you can cross-examine?
Yes, sir. And at that point, after the court issued that ruling, it would have been in direct violation of the motions in limine and also unethical for the defense counsel to then go up to her trial and cross-examine her on her drug use. And again, we did have a good faith basis to make this request.
But there was a suggestion of marijuana use in addition to smoking, using the pipe.
Well, the only proffer proof was that a drug pipe was found the next day in the complainant's room by the defendant's wife. However, not all the evidence was fleshed out, so to speak. The defense counsel in this case gave the court another avenue, which was to schedule a 104 hearing in order to get all the relevant evidence before the court made a determination on whether the cross-examination on the drug use would be allowed. And that would have been the prudent and proper course to have taken in this case because, again, recollection and perception of the complainant in this case was the sole issue. There was no physical evidence. There was no third-party witness and no admission.
What was the good faith basis? You mentioned that the attorney had a good faith basis.
We did.
What's the good faith basis to cross-examine the marijuana use? That's part of the record.
Well, the pipe was found in the complainant's room.
So somebody smokes a pipe and they use marijuana?
That's not.
Okay, so what's the good faith basis for the marijuana?
That, not necessarily marijuana, but that she smoked some sort of substance that could have affected her recollection and perception of the events. And the
was it on the record as to what kind of pipe it was?
Just the drug pipe. That was the
and there was an odor.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
And they smelled an odor. So it could have been.
They smelled an odor emitting from the pipe. It was found in the room, found in the next day. The only person with access to that room for the last 4 months was the complainant. There was a reasonable inference that could have been drawn that she had smoked that pipe. And again, during the 104 hearing, more evidence could have came out that might have been more relevant in the case. An analogy I could give is, what if the pipe had been found next to her toothbrush or next to her car keys? This would have given the defense even a greater inference, greater good faith basis to ask whether the complainant in fact used the pipe to smoke drugs and whether it affected her perception and recollection. And that would have been that would have been proper question, and the complainant could have answered yes or no, and that would have been the end of the situation if she answered no, which would have been proper again under not sure if I misquoted the case. It might have been State versus Sabag that was the controlling case on this issue. They cited several federal and cases from other jurisdictions where the potential for defendant's rights being hindered outweighs the prejudicial effect of allowing the defendant to at least ask the question of whether the complainant used the drugs or not. And if the answer was no, then that would have been the end of the line of questioning. So in this case, defense was precluded from even asking whether she used it at all. And see, my time is up. I'd like to save it for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Mr. Say. We'll hear from Mr. Tsushima at this point.
May it please the Court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Steven Tsushima, on behalf of the State of Hawaii. Good morning, Chief Justice, Associate Justices. I assure you, as I stand here before you to prepare to present my argument, I am not under the influence of any intoxicating liquor. And the beer in my refrigerator at my apartment does not make it more probable or less probable that what I just told you was true. And so, under that same rationale, that Deborah Flowers' testimony with regard to the pipe that she found in the complainant's room was not relevant.
Counsel, suppose that instead of finding that pipe, they had found a set of glasses with really thick lens in her belongings the very next day. Would you tell us that they couldn't question her about the glasses?
No, I believe they could question.
So her. A pipe you can't, but glasses you can?
No. We submit that they could have.
What if it was a wine glass with a bottle next to it and a little bit of wine left over?
Would they have been allowed to cross-examine the complaining witness with regard to that? Just as I was about to answer Justice Pollack's question, yes, we submit defense was fully entitled to cross-examine the
witness.
Then
why would a wine glass be relevant? Why would wine be relevant? Perception and recollection?
Just to make it absolutely clear, our position was defense was not precluded from cross-examining the witness with regard to the pipe. What defense was explicitly and clearly not allowed to do was to present Aunt Deborah's testimony with regard to the pipe that she had discovered, and that's what the ruling was made in the motions in limine.
Excuse me, the notice of intent says this, that by and through counsel hereby gives notice that he may seek to introduce evidence of other crimes, wrongs, or acts involving the complaining witnesses. That's what the notice says. And then the reference is to a pipe. It doesn't mention that the intent is to introduce only the pipe or who it's going to be brought through. It says that the intent is to elicit evidence regarding the discovery of the pipe.
Correct.
And the motion is denied in its entirety. So the defense counsel was precluded from bringing in reference to it through a pipe, through what was found, or any mention of it whatsoever, cross-examine, which is introduction, or independent admission.
Well, Justice Pollack, that's where we disagree. When you look at the motion in limine, the transcript, pages 57 through 62 cover the discussion of the pipe. As you read the motions in limine in its order as it's occurring, the judge is going through the defense's motion in limine, as you just mentioned. The judge is going through A, B, C, D. The judge did not deny the motion altogether. The judge was going one by one and saying what was denied and what was going to be accepted. And then when it came to D, specifically, I think it might have been on page 60 or 61, where the court says, as to D, the court is denying. D was just, as I was pointing out, was just a discussion with regard to the pipe. So that's all that the circuit court had precluded the defense from presenting, was the evidence as to D. When packing up the complainant's personal belongings on or about March 14, 2007, Ms. Kalawa discovered a pipe. It goes on, I don't need to read the whole paragraph for you to understand that it was D that was denied and not the cross-examination. With regard to the sort of passing request, oral, in the alternative request, that was only made orally, and the state would agree that there was no ruling made on that. But also, it wasn't further requested by the defense. It was just in the middle of argument with regard to the discussion of bringing in the pipe, that it was sort of just in passing noted that I should be able to cross-examine the complainant with regard to drug use. And when that's mentioned on page 60, it says, but it's relevant because if she was smoking marijuana at the time of this incident or she was under the influence of drugs, again, that goes to her perception. The court says, yeah. The court agrees that, yeah, but, and then the court is cut off. So the court is agreeing with defense counsel that, yeah, you do get to cross for that reason, but we're discussing the pipe right now. The court doesn't say that, but the court says, yeah, but, and it's cut off. The discussion then continues with regard to the pipe, and only with regard to the pipe. And so it's the state's position from the get-go, from our briefing, and today that defense was never precluded from cross-examining the complainant with regard to drug use as it's permitted under Sabag.
So you think when the court says, I think the evidence is so remote, so tangential, so unreliable as to whether or not this is Ms. Nishiti's pipe and whether she smoked it in the early morning hours, that this court should not allow this? So you think the court would have allowed cross-examination as to whether she smoked the pipe?
Absolutely. Because the way that paragraph reads, Your Honor, in all due respect, if I may read it again, it says, I think the evidence, and again, when you read it in the context of the way the motions in limine is being discussed, they're just discussing D. They're going in order, A, B, C, D.
What was A again?
What was A? I'm sorry. A was, complainant has been suffering from depression and received medication.
What was B? Condition.
During her childhood, the complainant had resided in the same home.
What was C?
In November 2006, complainant lied to Ms. Clark and claimed that her husband was beating her in order to make Ms.
And what
Clark
was E? What was E?
What was E? During the 4 months that complainant resided with defendant and his family, complainant was not working.
D was the only thing that dealt with the drugs, right?
Correct.
And the court granted the motion. I'm sorry. Denied, said that D would not be allowed, correct?
D. And what was contained within D was just the factual, just the factual evidence with regard to the pipe. So I will read it in its entirety. It's when packing up the complainant's personal belongings on or about March 14, 2007, Mrs. Calara discovered a pipe in the room the complainant had been using. Mrs. Calara called HPD to do a test on the pipe. The pipe had a bulbous end and smelled funny. Previously, this room had only been used by defendant's 9-year-old daughter. So it's only as to D that the court had made its ruling. It's very explicit, too.
But if you look at the court's ruling, the court says the evidence is so remote, so tangential, and so unreliable as to whether or not this is her pipe and whether she smoked it on March, in the early morning hours of March 13th, that the court should not allow this. And under that rationale, I understand your interpretation is the court is talking about admitting evidence that the auntie found the pipe. But under that same rationale, why would the court allow cross-examination? What would be the good faith basis for a question on cross-examination about drug use if the court's finding is it's too remote to allow the pipe?
Well, because my understanding is under Sabag, you are at least allowed cross-examination with regard to drug use on or about the time.
Shouldn't
the
court have said that?
At that moment, to clarify?
Because when defense counsel also requested the 104, not just to, with respect to the pipe, but also to cross-examine the CW as to whether she used the pipe on that morning, and if so, whether drug use affected her perception of the incident, but the court denied that request for a 104. Mm-hmm. So isn't it fairly clear that the court was saying, you know what, no evidence with respect to drug use?
No, I have to disagree. What the court was doing, and this is just as a practical matter, the way trial courts handle motions in limine is they handle, they go down the list of the motion, and they deal with the issues as it's presented to them through the motion. Would it have been better and clearer for you guys on appeal now to read it in black and white and made a ruling as to the Sabag issue? Yes, it would have been easier. It is clear, and if counsel has anywhere that they can point out where the court explicitly says, no, I'm not going to allow cross-examination, well, I'd like to see it because it's not there. It wasn't addressed. What the court was addressing in you know, it would have been better to have explicitly said, no, obviously under Savak you can cross-examine for those reasons. Yeah, that would have been better, but what the
suppose she had said, suppose she had said, if she'd been allowed to ask that question, if she'd asked, and if the question had been asked and the response would have been, no, I've never smoked, I don't, anything, could they have brought in the pipe?
The evidence of the pipe, no. Because that would have been brought in just for improper purposes, not allowable under Savak, because what...
Is it collateral? Is that the argument? Yes. My understanding was that when it goes to perception, it's not collateral. It's just like bias. It's never collateral.
It is collateral because they wouldn't be able to establish when the pipe was used, and under Savak, it's only relevant if it goes to the perception and recollection.
They couldn't establish when it was used because they weren't given a 104 hearing.
No, because on their offer of proof, they weren't able to establish it. They were given the offer of proof of what it's going to, what they're bringing Aunt Clara's testimony in for, what she would be able to testify to. And she would never be able to testify as to ever observing the complainant using the pipe. In fact, there was no offer of proof at all from defense that anybody would ever testify that they've ever seen her smoke any drugs. So there's no testimony anywhere that anybody ever knew she smoked drugs, had seen her smoke drugs, had smelled drugs around the house. She lived there 3 to 4 months. And there's not going to be any of that. All Aunt Clara was going to testify to was the discovery of a pipe in the bedroom amongst her belongings.
So well, she was going to testify. She lived there for, I don't know what it is, 4 months. Nobody else went into the room, etc. I wanted to ask you about the hearsay statement to Aunt Teresa. How is the statement to Aunt Teresa a excited utterance?
I believe we agree with the ICA's ruling with regard to that it would not actually fall under the excited utterance.
So it should not have been admitted in evidence.
But it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, let me ask you first. Then it should not have been admitted in evidence.
Correct.
And why would it be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Because under Clark, as we had discussed, or as counsel had brought up earlier, when there's evidence that is otherwise admissible and presented, and this is just duplicative of that evidence, then it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, you claim it's merely cumulative in your brief. But in this case, it was a matter of credibility, right?
Right.
There are no witnesses to this incident. And so you had simply the testimony of the complaining witness, and you had the testimony of the defendant. So wouldn't this testimony to Aunt Teresa be used to help the jury or to aid the jury in weighing who should be believed?
No, it would not, because all it did was, all it was repeating the facts that otherwise...
If that were the case, excuse me, Mr. Tsushima,
yes.
Why did you folks elicit this testimony?
It was just to explain the process by which the case was ultimately reported to the police, because it was a late reporting case. It wasn't reported immediately when she woke up or when right after the incident occurred. She didn't pick up the phone, call the police. It was to explain how it eventually ended up in front of Detective Denault.
So is that the way it was presented to the jury or argued to the jury?
In fact, it was not argued at all to the jury. The prosecutor only argued the demeanor of the witness as it pertained to Aunt Teresa. She never repeated the hearsay statements that were said to her.
Even if that were your purpose, was that purpose ever explained? It's not in the briefs. And I don't see it in the record. Was that purpose ever explained?
I believe it was to the extent that as the deputy was explaining the incident, it was only used in the time frame of explaining.
Assuming it only went to procedure.
Correct.
Let me get back to that. Assuming it went only to procedure, would it have a harmful effect in terms of bolstering the testimony of the complaining witness? I mean, could the jury use that testimony to verify what the complaining witness testified to?
I would say not. And to the extent that it was only stated as very basic facts, the hearsay statements that were stated, I believe, were just that defendant had touched her, was in the room under her shirt.
Was the hearsay testimony by the detective, well, I take that back, was the testimony by the detective about probable cause error?
I believe there are some cases that say that that sort of testimony is not relevant. As I had argued in my brief, it was relevant to just show the time frame and to show general police procedures.
If it wasn't relevant, should it have been admitted?
To the extent that it wasn't relevant and should not have been admitted, it still did not harm defendant's right to a fair trial. This did not prejudice defendant to the extent that it should be reversible error.
If it's not relevant, what could the prosecution's theory be behind even asking the question, except to bolster the credibility of the complaining witness?
The theory and the reason it was brought into evidence was just, again, just to show the time frame of what occurred and how the case comes before the jury. It has very minimal nominal relevance or use. I do agree with that, and that probably a future use, the prosecutor shouldn't be asking that question. It's not
to ask a police officer what constituted probable cause. That is showing a procedure. That is, doesn't that just go to the substance of the matter?
It was just to show what it's one of those testimony or evidence that's used just to explain what occurred next. It wasn't used by the prosecutor in closing argument or argued in any way that it otherwise showed that the complaining witness was credible. And that's the argument they're otherwise presented, is that it bolstered the complainant's credibility. But it doesn't do that, because what the layman person knows is that people who get arrested are oftentimes found not guilty. So it doesn't make the defendant guilty, or doesn't prejudice the defendant.
In opening statement by the prosecutor said, talking about Detective Denault, after hearing the complaining witness's statement and seeing her identify the defendant, the detective decided to arrest the defendant for sexual assault in the fourth degree. So isn't it implicit in that after hearing her, assessing her credibility, that he found her credible? Isn't that where that's kind of going?
I think that's the argument that they're making. I disagree with that. There's no statement in there by the detective that a determination of credibility or whether the complainant is credible is part of the process of finding probable cause.
If the officer thought that she wasn't credible, would he have arrested the defendant?
Quite possibly. There's nothing in the record to say that that is part of the process, that the detective is supposed to make a determination whether the complainant is credible or not credible or believable or not. In actuality, that's not part of the process. There's nothing that says that it's part of the detective or police officer's job to determine the credibility of a witness. I don't know that that's ever been testified to in a case or brought in at trial. And that's a general layperson's understanding of how the system works, is that a person may be brought in.
Then why introduce it? Excuse me, why introduce it if everybody understands the process? You're making the argument it doesn't matter because everybody knows it, but if everybody knows it, why introduce it?
I agree, and that's where I'm agreeing that it does have its minimal and nominal relevance, and that, you know, it probably should be avoided, but is it reversible error? Is it such that this court should be concerned that defendant did not have a fair trial? And that's where my understanding of the same cases that say it should not be brought in, there's not a case out there that says this is reversible error.
I'd like to get back to the pipe issue.
Sure.
It seems like, would you agree that the trial court seemed to be ruling that unless the defense could show that the pipe had been used that morning, or she was under the influence of whatever was in that pipe that morning, it would not be relevant?
Correct.
Okay. But doesn't Sabog actually stand for the proposition that a defendant is entitled to cross-examine a complaining witness as to not only her drug use, but also addiction, at or near the time of the incident to the extent that it might have affected her perception or recollection of the alleged event.
Right.
And also cites to U.S. versus Wilson, where the United States Supreme Court also ruled that the right to confrontation, cross-examine, was violated by not allowing a complaining witness to be cross-examined as to morphine, not only morphine use, but addiction.
Correct.
So isn't it fairly clear that not allowing any evidence of cross-examination as to drug use violates Sabag here, even without the foundation of whether or not she used, she was, she, you know, had used it that morning?
No, I don't believe it did. What the circuit court was nailing down, I believe, was exactly what you're trying to point out, or what you're pointing out with regard to what Sabag is saying, is relevant on or about the time that the incident occurred. The court may have been more exact in saying on the date, that you can't show that it happened on the date of the incident, but I think what the court was getting at was on or about the incident, because it's not relevant if it pertains to drug use months ahead. That is not what Sabag stands for. That it pertains at, it is pertinent as it pertains to the witness's perception and recollection. What Sabag cites to are 10 cases in which it discusses whether expert testimony would be necessary in determining whether there was drug use.
Is it the state's position that defense counsel can ask a question about a complaining witness's drug use without any good faith basis for believing that complaining witness used drugs?
No, they would still have to have a good faith basis in asking that question.
And in essence here, didn't the court rule that there was no good faith? Isn't that the apparent ruling? Was it there would be no, the only basis proffered was that a pipe was found. The court says, I'm not going to allow the pipe. How is it that you get from that to, wouldn't it be a reasonable conclusion for defense counsel to believe if that's the only good faith basis that's out there, I can't ask about drug use?
With all due respect, no, because there was a good faith basis. There's a difference between good faith basis for asking a question and admissibility of evidence or testimony. What the court was ruling on was the testimony would not be relevant because they had not established that Aunt Deborah's testimony would relate to on or about the time.
So let me be sure I'm clear. You're saying the defense counsel could have said, isn't it true that you used drugs on the night of this incident? Absolutely good question. Without any basis for asking it.
No, they did have a basis.
What was the basis if not the pipe? What was the basis if not the pipe?
If not the pipe, that was the only basis otherwise.
The court said, I'm not going to let the pipe in. The court said, too remote, too funky, too far away, don't know.
And what I'm saying is you can have a good faith basis for a question, but the evidence admissible, the testimony, not be relevant.
Wait a minute.
Not be admissible.
I want to make sure I understand you. You're saying that there was a good faith basis and the defense could have asked the question, and regardless of the response, it's okay for the court to make a predetermination as to whether or not the evidence is going to come in.
Oh, not regardless to the response. Well, regardless.
The court's excluded it.
I would agree regardless.
If the court was going to go along on your theory, why wouldn't it have said, okay, you can ask questions, but you can't admit that evidence until we hear what the answer is to that question.
I would have to take back what I said. It would be regardless to response because the court had already heard the offer of proof. Sorry, I misspoke.
Then, but the court also denied the request for a 104 to ask the CW these questions, correct? I mean, did you smoke that morning or the night before?
Correct.
Were you under the influence?
Correct.
Were you addicted?
Because my understanding, my reading of the record is this, that the court was not denying those cross-examination questions. In the cases in Sabag, defense counsel is allowed to ask those questions and then live with the answer, whether it's yes or no, live with the answer. So my reading of the record was the court was allowing those questions. When the defense counsel presented it to the court agreed, yeah, but implying, yeah, you can ask those questions, but let's talk about that pipe. So I'm absolutely saying yes, that defense counsel could have asked this question. If defense counsel was left with some other impression, that's defense counsel's own fault, because defense, it was never explicitly denied or precluded from.
So you think that there should be a separate ineffective assistance of counsel petition here?
No, I don't think there should be an ineffective, because there's the classic theory that you don't ask a question you don't know the answer to. So my feeling is defense counsel no longer wanted to pursue that questioning. That's not ineffective. To make it clear, there's nothing in the record to say that the complainant used drugs or was a drug user. There was no offer of proof to that. There's just nobody that was presented to even say that she was a drug user, and I think defense counsel decided, we don't have evidence of that.
Is there anyone to say that the pipe was planted? Is there anyone who's disputed where the pipe was found or that she was the only one in the room? Is there anything disputing any of that?
There's nobody disputing that. There are facts to at least point out that it's not as isolated as defense is making it out to be. While complainant was the only one that occupied that room, there wasn't an offer of proof that she was the only one that was allowed into that room. That was the room that was the same house that defendant lived in. That was the same house that had two other teenagers that lived in that house.
I think there was some representation on the reason for having the 104 hearing about that. But let me ask you about the statements that were admitted about the defendant making advances to the complaining witness in January and February of 2007. Why was that admissible, those statements?
That was admissible for, as it was discussed earlier, for intent, state of mind, lack of consent.
But if those issues were not raised, the defendant taking the position that that the incident never happened, why would they be relevant?
Well, it would still be relevant to prove state of mind, and it's on the state to prove the elements of the offense, so it's still the state's burden before a defendant even takes a stand or puts on a case to prove state of mind. So of course it's relevant to prove lack of consent, intent, state of mind. We don't know if they're going to, and they don't have to put on the defense.
So these are hearsay statements, right?
There were statements made by the defendant.
So how do they come in? I mean, you folks went on 404B. How are they admissible?
As an admission or statement by a party opponent.
Is that what the basis was for admitting them?
Well, there's no challenge to that, so obviously that would be the basis for admitting them.
I thought in the motion in limine, they came in as 404B stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
So not as what you said as party admissions.
But it wasn't challenged on any hearsay basis.
You don't raise party admissions here. You don't raise party admissions as a basis for allowing this evidence in.
No, but they don't challenge it on hearsay basis.
You raise it on 404B basis, right?
Correct.
It's a prior bad act.
Correct.
Is this a prior bad act?
It's in a minimal, nominal way, because it's not a conviction or some kind of crime to show romantic interest in another person. What it was relevant to, though, was state of mind, lack of consent. It wasn't like he did anything like groping her or anything that would be criminal. That would be then extremely prejudicial against defendant. It was just nominally.
If it was nominal and only for that, you say somewhat limited basis. So shouldn't, when you allow these kinds of statements into evidence, the court give a limiting instruction, because the jury then will be free to use this evidence for any purpose instead of, as you say, the limited purpose of showing state of mind, as the court said, or intent or lack of consent?
Sure. The court should give a limiting instruction if requested by the defendant or by the defense.
Only if requested by the defendant?
Well, yes, because in this case, strategically, defense might have made a call not to want to request a limiting instruction. As we know from a practical...
Well, didn't the defense raise in a motion in limine objections to these statements?
Correct.
So that would be somewhat inconsistent with not highlighting this.
Not at all, because as I was going to say, as a practical sense, when a limited instruction is given, we all know in court there's kind of a halt brought to the testimony where the court says, now I'd like to instruct you to the testimony that's about to be given by the witness. The testimony is to be used, you know, for this limited purpose. It highlights
so the
evidence.
Court, so the court knew that this evidence was supposed to be admitted only for a very limited purpose.
Correct.
In fact, I think the court said, well, you know, it's a statement. It's not as bad as an act. So shouldn't the court then, knowing the limited purpose for which this was to be considered by the jury, after having gone through an on-the-record discussion with counsel, told the jury that, look, you're only to consider this evidence, assuming this evidence was admissible, for this limited purpose?
And I have to disagree. Only, as Rule 104 says, it's only upon the request of a party. And I think it would be improper in this case for the court to have done that because, as I pointed out, it's highlighting the evidence. Defense counsel probably made, and I would say a problem.
You know, highlighting the evidence, you're talking about attorney strategy. I'm thinking in terms of a constitutional right, to a fair trial, which would overrule or, as I guess, supersede any rule of evidence. But in this particular case, the court knows that the jury should only consider this evidence for a limited purpose. So shouldn't the court, in terms of ensuring the administration of justice, regardless of what the party's strategies may be, in fairness to the jury, tell the jury that, look, this evidence can only be considered for these purposes. So when you get back to the jury room, those are the only purposes you are to consider this evidence for and nothing else.
When the evidence is so prejudicial to the defendant, I fully agree that that's when the court should be instructing the jury that the evidence is to be used for a limited purpose. Otherwise, in evidence like this, where it's not that prejudicial to defense, as Rule 104 states, it's only upon request of defense. So no, I don't believe in this case, based on this evidence, that it would be reversible error for the court to not have instructed with regard to the prior instances. I think my time has run out.
Mr. Tsushima, we've been asking you questions during this last 5 minutes, so if you can have a few minutes to wrap up if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. There is one last thing I wanted to point out. Was in Sabag, there was, I think I was pointing out, there were 10 cases that the court looked at. In particular, one case stood out to me, and that was Blumhagen versus State. It was a Supreme Court of Wyoming case. And in that case, the facts are somewhat similar in that it points out what Sabag stands for and what the proposition is for. In that case, the defense counsel conceded that she did not expect to elicit testimony showing that the confidential informant was using drugs while she was acting as a confidential informant. Essentially, what they had was another witness that was going to say that they had witnessed the confidential informant using drugs during the summer of 97. What that court found was that that testimony about the drug use during the summer amounted to extrinsic evidence concerning a specific instance of the confidential informant's conduct and was not therefore admissible to attack credibility. The court concluded that the trial court's not allowing Cowley's testimony with regard to the confidential informant's prior drug use was not relevant. And that's the argument that we've been making today, is that it wasn't relevant. Under Sabag, it's only relevant as it pertains to the witness's perception and recollection on or about the time of the incident. And Aunt Kalara's testimony was not going to establish when that drug was used, if that drug was used.
When did she move in?
She had moved in about 3 or 4 months prior to the incident.
December of 2007, right?
Of 2006.
December of 2006.
Yes.
So several months before this incident.
Several months before, and there was going to be no testimony by anybody that the complainant was a drug user, had seen her use drugs, smelled drugs, or that there's any drugs around or about the house. There was no offer of proof to any of that, and that's why Aunt Kalara's testimony with regard to discovering a pipe just wasn't relevant.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Tsushima. Mr. Say, your rebuttal. How much time does Mr. Say have in? Well, we'll give you a little extra because we questioned you quite a bit during your last minutes of your opening.
Thank you, sir.
As well. So we'll give you a couple more minutes past that.
Well, the sole issue in this case can be argued that it's perception, and recollection. The only witness that testified as to the events of that night was the complainant, if the inadmissible hearsay from Aunt Teresa is not submitted. The State versus Sabah, the holding in that case is clear that if there's a good faith basis, if the defendant can have a reasonable inference that drug use may have affected the perception and recollection of the complainant, that it is proper for the defendant to at least question on it. And again, they cited case law from different jurisdictions that states that at least the defendant should be allowed to ask. If the answer is no, that's the end of the situation, the questioning. Based on the discussions and the motions in Lynn, it's clear to counsel that defense was precluded from even questioning about any alleged drug use affecting her recollection or perception. On page 61, after Ms. Durant again urged the court for a 104 hearing, the court denied that request, stating, the court's ruling is that a 104 hearing is not going to be able to establish who used the pipe, when it was used, and therefore it has no relevance to the case, which we disagree with. There, again, standing alone, these errors are already not harmless. They demand a vacation, to vacate the conviction on their own. But the more grave concern here is the cumulative prejudicial effect caused by the not allowing the defendant to cross-examine on the drug use, allowing in the inadmissible hearsay of Aunt Teresa, allowing the detective to testify about probable cause when the court realized the dangers of confusing the jury between probable cause and beyond a reasonable doubt, by allowing defendant's statements from January, alleged statements from January 2007 and February 2007, and again, not having a limiting instruction in regards to this statement when it's clear that the court recognized the only limited purpose for these statements to go towards the defendant's intent and lack of consent. And therefore, we respectfully ask the court to vacate Mr. Calaro's conviction and to remand him.
Thank you very much to both of our counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement.